All right, welcome to this evening's session. We're talking about left-handedness, but as I mentioned, we're really going to be exploring this as a broader model for really how you might think about uniformity and diversity concerns in community writ large. But specifically, I want to play it out in terms of how it might help in the context of thinking about varieties of sexualities in the human experience and in human society. And I want to say just one framing thing about that. In this room, both I assume in terms of personal opinion, personal experience, but also in terms of communal policy and approach, in terms of where everyone is coming from, there is a wide range. There are people who I think feel they are really just at sort of the tip of the iceberg of thinking about how do we reevaluate certain Jewish assumptions around sexuality, heteronormativity, any number of other terms around kind of how we structure Jewish sexual life, and just even thinking about what does it look like to come to a new frontier on that, where does my community even want to go, and other folks in this room for whom it is like a done deal that a lot of those questions have been completely kind of reconfigured. And what I would humbly suggest to you is that across that spectrum of policy, there is still not, to my mind, a clear and well-settled way that people draw a line from the Torah to who they are and what they are doing and feel 100% great about that. Okay? And I want to just sort of put that out there because I think we can fall into a trap of like, oh, either I've figured this out or, you know, I don't know what there is to figure out here and sort of evaluate it all on, well, will I perform a same-sex wedding? Will I not? Who has a membership policy in my shul? Who doesn't? And that stuff is all very important and also important, I think, for anyone who is trying to actually be an heir of the tradition in some way is how do I connect those dots? Now, some are fine and content with not always connecting the dots, right? That is to say, yeah, I live on the other side of a certain revolution. For some of us, the narrative is, yeah, you know, there was a rupture with the destruction of the Second Temple. There were all kinds of pieces that just were kind of broken. We remade something new, and there's different kind of ruptures we're going through in modernity, and things break, and there's something new that we have to make. And I don't hold myself to that standard, and that's fine. This exercise and this engagement and this conversation tonight is going to be from the perspective of presuming that wherever you are on how much you need to hold together narratives of sort. All right, welcome to this evening's session. This is that many people want to connect those dots and that there is value in connecting those dots if you are able to. Whether you wait around until you can connect the dots to do certain things is a separate question. But I think a sort of like the general project of how does one minimize cognitive dissonance between oneself and the Torah from one end and really try to be a student of the Torah in the sense of really learning from it and being shaped by it, I think still holds a lot of sway and ought to hold a lot of sway for people in terms of thinking about an integrated religious life. That's the sort of big picture that I want to say about that. And I want to do something a little unusual in this sort of shiur slash discussion, which is I want to kind of start from the end and fit some of the data that you saw in Seder into it. That is to say, play out some of the models that I think we see in some of those sources and sort of refer to them and slot them in. And then we'll go back and talk specifically about some of the sources and what's at stake in that discussion. And then hopefully also have some time to play out what do we think is useful about this, what is limited about it, and happy if we have time to reflect on kind of some of the feedback I've received in various ways around this. Okay. So I want to claim to you that emerging from the sources you've seen, in halachic sources you see at least, what I've identified, five different models of coping with, responding to, handedness. All right? So let's get the poll out of the way. How many people in the room are left-handed? Okay. higher than the average percentage across the population. It's about 10% in the broader population. How many people would describe themselves as ambidextrous? Okay, we got one. About 2% of the population at large describes that way. So that's a little more representative in terms of the room. How many people would describe themselves as left-footed? It's hard with Americans. Europeans know this much better because they play soccer. Great. There are some people who are left-footed, even though they're right-handed and vice versa. I'm not going to do the poll of who bats lefty, throws righty, and all of those kinds of things. Obviously, my saying, are you right-handed, you already had to make some kind of conclusion about, well, do I write with this hand? Do I do other things? What are the activities? But this is something that for a long time has obviously been known to be part of the human population. Yeah.
Do you know if there's a higher percentage among Jews of left-handed people?
Yeah, we have data on that. Or yeah. Great. So stipulated.
Also, this room could be self-selecting. You could have more people.
Correct. There are things people talk about, like left-handed people are more represented in the arts and in creative professions. And is clergy sort of, you know, sort of a wing of that, and spiritual seekers and all sorts of things of that sort? I don't have the data or the science on that. We do know from the Torah that Shevet Binyamin was disproportionately left-handed. Because in the story of, really two stories, I mean, there's the famous judge Ehud ben Gera, who was from the tribe of Binyamin, who was described as Ishi Ter Yad Yimino, indicating that already back in biblical times, this is a type we know about and we name. But also in the civil war between the tribe of Binyamin and the rest of Israel, they had 300 crack slingshot shooters with their left hand that were clearly a part of their success in at least the early stage of that battle. So the Iter Yad Yimino, part of what's interesting about it is it's a population that sort of can't be denied, wished away, ignored, of course, right, in recent history and post the Industrial Revolution, people did try to wish away the left-handed. I don't know if anyone here grew up being trained to sort of switch, it's a population that there's something that is sort of stable about its presence. It's also undeniably a minority, right? It's also clear that sort of the majority of society is going to, and then we can argue, does it need to or not, organize itself primarily around right-handed people? And yet, how do you respond, right? And thus enter the models. You're creating institutions, you're creating expectations, you're creating frameworks. How do you cope with this roughly 10% minority that is different, has different needs, assumptions than the larger group? All right, and I want to just lay these out and sort of explain them to you and refer to some of the texts that you saw, and then we'll go down and break some of those apart. The first model, the first way you can deal with difference of a portion of the population that is just not the same, is to exclude them. Okay, right? Strategy one is, yeah, whether I go all the way to the level of those people are bad, they are sinister, right, which is a word that comes from the expression, the Latin for left, the notion that actually there's something bad about this deviance from the norm, or even if it's much more kind of low-key, a notion of, yeah, we just can't accommodate that, right? That's just not what we're... Good luck to you, but this framework can't really help out with that. One model is exclusion, okay? You know, we exclude people all the time from things based on that, right? People with poor eyesight are not going to get into the Air Force at the same level, right? Until you develop a technology that you think compensates, right? But like, we do things like that all the time. You interpret there's some activity that requires a certain skill, a certain way of being and caring, whether it's your body or something else in the world. Some people don't have it, and they're not going to be the top people in that group. You see this at work with left-handedness in the halachic sources around the mikdash. The sources around the mikdash that you started with, in very stark terms, say, iter pasul. Okay, a left-handed Kohen is invalid to serve. And I want to be clear here. It doesn't mean he's invalid to do it with his right because he's a lefty, but it's okay for him to use his left. No, he is pasul. He is out. He is neither allowed to pass as a righty, the second category we'll get to in a minute, nor is he allowed to act based on his own hand dominance. He's simply not eligible to be a part of the avodah. For those of you who got to the supplemental sources, there's a kind of crazy parallel view to this cited in the Ramban around chalitza, the ritual of, you know, taking off the shoe and spitting, and the mini divorce basically that happens between brother-in-law and sister-in-law in the wake of the brother dying without children. And the Ramban says, yeah, if the brother-in-law is left-footed, you can't do chalitza. Because the assumption is it needs to be done on the right foot, but that the right foot also is expected to be the dominant foot that the person sort of leads with when they start walking. So this guy's stuck. Now there, of course, excluding him from chalitza has terrible consequences for his sister-in-law. And so exclusions are not always just targeted to the person in question. They may have ripple effects. But nonetheless, that's a model. All right, that's a model that you see. All right, I'm just going to go through all of these, just sort of give us an overview. That's number one. Model number two is what I'm calling passing. Okay? And I quite consciously borrow that, right, from also the terminology that we talk about around sexuality. All right? Passing here is the notion that, yeah, okay, there's some people who are different. We acknowledge that. And there's a standard everyone is supposed to follow. But we allow people, if they're willing, to follow the sort of conformity standard to fall into line, right? What that would mean in the temple model, which they do not play out, is left-handed kohanim are welcome as long as they use their right hand when they do the various avodot, right? That's what passing would look like. I don't deny that there are itrei yad, there are such people, but there's not an accommodation for them, okay? They are not thrown out of the community, as it were, okay? But there is one standard. So if you got to the itur on lulav and etrog, you saw what that looks like, which is to say, the Talmud says, etrog in the left, lulav in the right, and though that is based on the notion, really, that the right hand is more important, and therefore one might think, as Rabbeinu Yoel in the earlier source said, which we'll get to later, you might think a lefty therefore reverses the lulav and etrog, according to the itur and his ruling, and this is the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch and standard Sfaradi practice until today. No, we don't accommodate that. Everyone's got to look the same. For the lefties, it'll be a little awkward. It'll feel weird. They're like, why am I holding the etrog in my important hand? It's only one mitzvah and I don't have three. Okay, that's what it is. That's what everyone does. We're sort of following the majority. All right? Or the position of the Meiri that everyone wears tefillin on the left arm. Okay? He has another reason. We'll get back to that. That's very interesting. Everyone's going to look the same. For you, it's going to be a little weird. It's going to be on your arm that you usually do things with. Whereas everyone else is going to have their dominant arm free. This is probably the origin of it, so they can wear tefillin all day and be working in the shop. Okay? You are not going to be able to do that. You got to pass. All right, that's the second model. Third model is what I'm calling the double burden model. Where you go further, you acknowledge the difference. You acknowledge that the difference makes it impossible for the person to pass as what the majority is like, but you can't really acknowledge a completely alternate model, right? In the context of sexuality, right, this translates into both warranting and expecting celibacy, right? You don't force someone or expect someone to kind of fall into line with a standard heterosexual relationship that's completely opposite to who they are or who they understand themselves to be. But neither do you create something different and new as a parallel. Okay? This is reflected, for instance, if you got to the supplemental sources, there's a more generous position on chalitza. This is the Ashkenazi norm. That left-footed men, they do chalitza. They just have to do it on both feet. Okay? You do the ritual twice. Okay? I can't just do it on your right. That's ridiculous. That's not your dominant foot. But I sort of can't have a woman being released from this relationship and going off and remarrying, the rabbinic sources would say, without a right foot having been dealt with, right, along the way. Or, more pointedly, Rabbi Yirmiah's position, who we'll come back to discussing in a minute, in Shabbat, in the discussion about when you're liable for writing with which hand on Shabbat. So Rabbi Yirmiah thinks, I'm a righty, okay? If I write with my right hand on Shabbat, that's a core violation of Shabbat. That's Chayav Chatat. If I write with my left, that's maybe Asur Midrabbanan, whatever. It's not a core violation of Shabbat. However, a lefty, okay, if President Obama were to write with his left hand, well, he would be Chayav HaChatat for writing on Shabbat. But if he wrote with his right hand, he would also be Chayav HaChatat. That is Rabbi Yirmiah's position there. We'll go back and look at that. But if you paid attention, he says, the Mishnah that says, HaKotev Shtei Otiyot, Bein Bimino, Bein Bismolo, someone who writes two letters, whether with their right or their left, he says, Be'iter Yad Shanu. That Mishnah is about a left-handed person. For a right-handed person, that would not be the case. But for a left-handed person, it is. And there, too, again, we can unpack it. The notion seems to be, well, on the one hand, when the lefty writes with their left hand, that's a big deal for them. And on the other hand, when the lefty writes with a right hand, that's a big deal for all the rest of us. That is to say, it's a meaningful act, sort of both from within and from without. And that creates yet a third model, which is this double burden model. Okay, the fourth model is what I'm calling mirror image. Here you step up a whole other level and you say, no, actually, lefties are just as much people as righties, just as much created by God as righties. And what that means is they sort of spawn mirror image halachic universes out of their respective dominance. So what does that look like? Well, that looks like Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi on Lulav and Etrog, where he'll say, yeah, it's very important. Righties have to take the Lulav in their right hand and the Etrog in their left. And of course, lefties need to reverse it. Or the Rambam on Tefillin, which is my daughter, who is a lefty, if I get up and I put on Tefillin on my right arm, I have not fulfilled the mitzvah. But if she gets up and puts on Tefillin on her left arm, she has not fulfilled the mitzvah. Because actually what happens here is we have halacha that's not about right or left, and we'll come back to this point in language in a minute. It is about dominance. And to the extent that this shared concept of dominance devolves differently on a varied population, you might have everyone following the same halacha, but applying it in a mirror image fashion. So you see that in Tefillin in the Rambam, you see that in Lulav and Etrog, you also see it in Abaye on Shabbat, where Abaye says, the only person who is chayav for violating Shabbat with either hand is an ambidextrous person. Because otherwise, the laws of Shabbat, and this will be important for us coming and thinking about the case of sexuality, the laws of Shabbat actually sort of bend and twist depending on your hand dominance. Okay? So again, you asked, writing left hand on Shabbat. Okay, so one time, it was a Shabbat afternoon, I was very nicely enjoying a nap, and get up to hear the shrieking sound of my then, three-year-old son, I think, or something like that, who had been, like, you know, chased by his older sister into a door, and had gashed his, forehead open. It wasn't clear, okay, did he need stitches, this or that, the other thing. It seemed like he needed stitches. So it was Shabbat afternoon, and I took him over to the hospital. But the whole way, right, along the way, was trying to minimize the violations of Shabbat that I was doing. I did think it was a pikuach nefesh situation in the sense of things could get infected and this and that. But also, there were things that I could perfectly just as well do. I didn't drive my own car over. I got a cab that I got on the phone and all sorts of things like that. But the key thing was when I came into the hospital and I had to sign him in, and I was like, well, actually, like, I can't sign because it's, you know, the Sabbath. And they were like, well, we need something, you know, for some kind of record. So I signed with my left hand, okay? Which is, you know, what you're supposed to do in those kinds of situations. But that only made any sense because I was a righty, right? Had I been a lefty and done that exact same thing, it would have not been in any way sort of lowering the voltage on what was happening. So that's what mirror image looks like. Fifth model, which I won't say too much about right now, but we'll kind of come back to hopefully at the end, is what I'm calling deconstruction, which is, I would say, the step beyond mirror image in this discussion would be to say, actually, writing no longer means what you think it means. Some version of saying the whole notion of what you think you're talking about handedness, actually no longer matters in a way that we don't have to care about left and right at all anymore. That could be in either direction. It could either be there's no out for non-dominance or there's no sort of points for dominance. I hopefully will make that clear sort of as we go forward, but suffice it to say, the way deconstruction is different from mirror image is mirror image still deeply cares about the underlying halacha category and value. It's just saying it's got to apply differently to people who are different. Deconstructing is already saying, I'm not sure we care about that category at all. So in the context of sexuality, for instance, let's just play that out. You take a verse like, Ve'et zachar lo tishkav mishkavei isha, okay? In Vayikra, that addressed, right, to a single male hearer, that verse says, you shall not lie with a man in the way you lie with a woman, okay? So a mirror image engagement with that verse would potentially say something like, oh, well, what is the underlying, who is that verse speaking to and why? Is that verse speaking to someone who is left-handed, as it were? That is to say, wired in a way that is different from the majority of the population? Or is that verse speaking only to a presumed majority of the population for whom that verse is maybe more intuitive in some kind of way in terms of what their sexual behaviors would be? And I want to sort of identify that. And then a mirror image reading of that verse would come out saying something like, just to use sort of simple binary terms here for a moment, that verse is only speaking to straight people. And it has a different assumption in terms of a portion of the population that's not going to fit into that category. Okay? That would be what a mirror image model looks like. It's like when the Torah screams, hey, make sure you put tefillin on your left hand, it's speaking to most people who are righties, but is meant to be applied in a way that is different to people with different handedness. Deconstruction would be something like, no, the whole presumption of that verse is about something to do with like exploitative sex and power and a certain notion of what even a marriage or a sexual coupling is about that no longer actually holds in the contemporary world. And therefore, I don't care about someone's orientation or sort of difference or category because I've made the whole category disappear. Right? Is that clear just as a distinction? Right? Mirror image actually leaves in place. It really matters what hand you put the tefillin on. I'm just saying, oh, I get it. Your left is different from my left. Deconstruction is, again, if I were to take it to tefillin, no, the whole reason we cared about tefillin in the first place being on one arm was because of manual labor and having the hand that you're using for manual labor free so that you can wear God's thing on your arm in a sustainable way all day long. Now that we don't have manual labor, so actually, whatever, pick an arm, any arm. It doesn't matter, Okay? Again, that's speculative. I'm not actually giving that as an answer here practically, but I'm giving you a sense of how those play out. Okay, let me just pause there. Any question just on sort of the definition of the models or any other data points that you saw in the Seder that you want to sort of interrogate or figure out how they fit in? And then I want to draw from a few of the examples that we saw some of this out. Yeah.
So I just want to say about the double
burden. Yeah.
Your example of, for the chalitza, a left-handed man has to do it both, and that's a double burden. I see that as a burden, not a huge burden, but annoyance. But then when you compared it to a gay person who therefore has to be celibate, it didn't...
Great, fantastic, fantastic. So this, you want to say something else about that?
I just don't think you can compare the two.
Good, so here's what I want to say. These, I think, are structurally the models that you see emerge. Here's what's so interesting to me and why I brought you all of these together. They all emerge as models in this larger framework that are deployed, sometimes agreed upon, sometimes argued over, which says, well, it's not really like what is halakha's answer to how to deal with lefties? There is no answer to that. There are clearly a range of answers. And then what that then forces us, I think, to ask is, why? Why some of these in some areas and others not? Okay? So you've already actually begun to give the beginnings of one answer, which then we can argue over and give others, which is to say, well, yeah, okay, double burden, I guess some people are doing that in a case where it's really not that big a deal. It almost feels like a formality, okay? Maybe I can be maybe a little more annoying to tell a lefty every day to put tefillin on both arms. But you might be like, well, okay, right, maybe. Then, however, right, you start to get to other areas of practice, assumptions, et cetera, and you may start to say, well, wait a minute, what's the cost there? So where I think you actually feel this very powerfully is, in the Mikdash model, I think you want to ask two things. One, if it's totally fine to exclude the lefty there, okay, I would have two questions that emerge from that. Why doesn't that happen in a lot of other places? Pretty much almost only happens in the Mikdash model and in this odd shita in the Ramban that really gets, you know, pushed aside, okay? Probably because it's like, well, it's one thing to throw someone out from being a Kohen who does the Avodah. It's another thing to say, this woman can never remarry because that guy's left-footed. Right? So that goes on some level to your point. But then the other question would be, well, what was going on here that we were okay with throwing the left-handed or left-footed Kohen out? So I don't want to get too deeply into that, but we can start to imagine any number of ways, which we might feel better or worse about, but I think we could at least understand. Well, maybe the Mikdash presents a unique set of things where it feels like the stakes are very high in terms of screwing up the worship in that context. Maybe there's even a technical concern about if the left-handed person tries to do things with their right hand, they will do it less proficiently. Maybe there are aesthetic concerns. The Mikdash has to look perfect. The Kohanim have to look perfect. Other kinds of blemishes on their body are disqualifying. And maybe also the cost is pretty low. Quite frankly, they're looking to disqualify as many Kohanim as possible. There's too many people who want the same jobs, right? We know this in Masechet Yoma. They're racing up the ramp in order to try to be the first ones to do a certain job in the morning. And in the bad stories there, they end up hurting each other and even killing each other. So the cost is low, right? If the Rockettes said, we only take right-footed people, we need everyone to be able to like kick intuitively at the same moment with the same kind of precision, so you might be aggravated by that. You might even advocate for there being a left-footed Rockettes or for changing the choreography, et cetera. But also, the stakes would be low because you don't expect everyone to necessarily be in that group. If you imposed, right, an exclusion model on a lefty vis-a-vis tefillin, that's a much deeper claim of, I'm actually backing off of the notion of universal obligation in mitzvot. That's already a higher cost. So I would just sort of turn your comment into, that's exactly the kind of engagement that I think paying attention to this can sharpen us to ask about. Well, what are the implicit costs and benefits, right? What does it mean? So implicitly, I agree with what you're saying 100%, but you can imagine people arguing over it. Implicitly, what you're saying is celibacy is a completely unreasonable expectation to have of a human being. Okay? Now, someone who didn't feel that way for whatever reason, so wouldn't be swayed by your analysis, would be like, well, no, I don't know. Like, maybe that person's supposed to be, you know, like Ben Azai. It's supposed to be like other people who have made great contributions but didn't play them out through some kind of lifelong sexual partnership with someone else. And then you'd go back and forth, right? So it's a great comment, right? And it really leads into, I think, what's at stake. Yeah, a few comments here.
Stop playing out from these sources. Some different ways of thinking about handedness. Maybe on one hand, there's such a thing as left-handedness and another thing that is right-handedness, or the right hand and the left hand. And another model would be that there's such a thing as, say, hand dominance, which can iterate as a left hand or a right hand or so on. That seems to be kind of in the mirror image thing, like you can sort of go either way in this principle of the thing called handedness. And back to the first, like there's an essence to being left-handed versus an essence to being right-handed. And maybe that's playing out here. And if so, and if we do a switch to sexuality, likewise, you might say there's such a thing as like gayness and straightness, or are they different iterations of sexuality?
Great. That will obviously have to do in part with, and sources I did not bring you, but that come up also is, so how do you, what about someone who's born a lefty but trains themselves to be a righty? What hand do they put tefillin on? Okay, that's not so simple, right? There's an engagement there. So some of it will come out with, well, do you recognize that person as now a righty? Or do you think of them as like a lefty that somehow contorted themselves into being a righty, but come on, you're really a lefty? So on some level, adjudicating the tefillin question will in part be about that. But it will, of course, in part be about, well, what is this thing really about? Part of what you see in the discussion between like the Meiri and the Rambam is the Meiri, at the end of the day, the reason he says everyone puts tefillin on the left hand is he denies that it's about hand dominance. Because the Meiri, if you got to that point, says, it says, v'samtem et dvarai eile al levavchem, ukshartem otam la'ot al yedchem, put it on your heart and tie it on your arm. So the Meiri says, yeah, there were a bunch of other rabbis in the sugya that thought it was about the non-dominant arm, but actually Rabbi Yitzchak at the end thought it was about something totally different. And that's the other thing that I think is really important and engaging about this. Implicitly, when you are deciding which of these models to deploy, you are actually commenting on what you think the mitzvah is. It's not just about, oh, should I let this person in? Should I not let this person in? It's about, what's it about? Right? So if you thought the mikdash was actually about an expectation that each person of Israel is supposed to come and at one point serve God at the altar, well, then you could never reach this conclusion. But long before you get that, you would realize, oh, actually, if most people of either hand went to serve God at the altar, they would be put to death. So that's not what it's about. It's about something else. Now, what it means that, you know, what would the mikdash, I mean, these are the big questions, right? What would the mikdash look like, right? If it were up today, what would be the assumptions? Who would tolerate what? You get some not great glimmers of that with the Kotel politics, right? But they're implicitly, right, adjudications of the mitzvah itself, of what it means. Great. Yeah. Anon, Eliana, Roni. Yeah.
I was fascinated by the language that for a lefty, we still call it yaminu small, but it means the opposite. Would that be an example of the mirroring?
So I want to spend a couple minutes on that Braita in Minachot, which we'll dip down on. I would say, I'm not sure whether it means the mirroring, but what is so great about that example of Yamin being both right and dominant, and the inability of the word itself to tell you the answer to that, is it really just reinforces the point that we were just discussing, which is, actually encoded in how you read Yamin is an assumption about what is going on. So the proof also, if you got to the supplemental sources on chalitza, at one point someone wants to say, chalitza is always on the right foot. Okay, it doesn't matter if you're a lefty or a righty. How do you know that? Because the Gemara compares the leg of the chalitza, what do you call him? It's not the victim, he's whatever. The man to whom chalitza is being done compares that leg to the leg of a mitzora, of someone recovering from tzarat, from scale disease, about whom the Torah says, you have to put blood and oil on bohed raglo haymanit, on the big toe of his right foot. And they basically say, well, so implicitly the question is, well, how do you know if that means right or it means dominant? So they say, well, you also have to put it on his earlobe. And there is no such thing as a dominant earlobe. So therefore, I know that it's just the south side of your body when you're facing east. Okay? Right? Some version of that. Now, of course, someone else could come back and be like, no, that's not right. It just picks the earlobe on the side of the dominant hand. Right? But the question of how you decode the word, part of what I think is so great, and if you saw like the Sifrei Dvarim on Tfilin, was also a great source of this, where it says, right, Yadcha and Zesmol, right? And then sort of trying to reconstruct how do you know that, and sort of realizing that actually, well, like the word hand and our image of like which hand is going forward is based both on assumptions of who the majority is, what do most people do, and how do we tend to use the word. Okay? So, Yamin Hashem Osachayu. So does that mean God's right arm does might? Well, yeah, in some standard anthropomorphic imagery that assumes the majority of humans, which they are righties, yeah. But it's pretty clear like the meaning of that verse is God's power. And Yamin is a shortcut word for power because that's how most people use their power when they need to do it. So that's the part that I think is like marvelous about this, is you can't say, right, this is actually the main thing, if you took away nothing else from this, you can't say, well, this sort of like literalist reading is that it means a compass direction. The creative reading is that it means dominance. I don't think you can say that. Neither of those is the root meaning. You're picking the meaning based on your understanding of the mitzvah, and by picking, I don't mean like, pick whatever you want. Like, ideally, you're trying to understand, right, what's going on here. Eliana.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the deconstruction idea. In the example you gave, it sounded like it's deconstructing, like, the verses and the mitzvot. And for me, like, when I read that, I think about, like, deconstructing the idea of handedness, like, for using this as a metaphor for sexuality, right? Like, in my experience and in my community, right, it like doesn't feel like handedness maps on in terms of like it's still binary and like what about, you know, like pansexuality and like how spectrums of sexuality in like interact with our spectrums of gender. And it just feels like, you know, all of the gender categories are just kind of like coming crumbling down, and that's fine. And I feel like that's what I'm deconstructing and what I see people deconstructing. So I'm wondering like how that works with this or how that interplays with deconstructing the mitzvot themselves. Like which are we deconstructing?
Yeah, well, I think they kind of go hand in hand. That is to say, I think implicitly, when you are deconstructing the meaning of a verse, you are deconstructing the category of whatever value or idea that was standing by it, and vice versa. And therefore, yeah. So for instance, there's one thing, we'll get to this in a moment. The category of handedness is not binary. It's not, right? There's left-handed, there's right-handed, there's ambidextrous. Then I alluded to other things of people who are born lefty but end up training themselves to be righty. So it's not actually so simple that it's binary, that we can talk about how that plays out.
Right.
So that's just as a note on that. But what it is assumed to be in the sources is sort of, for lack of a, this is a little too hard a term, but it's not that hard a term. There's something essentialist about it, right? It might have some fluidity. There might be able to be sort of overcome in some way with enough training, but there is a notion, and so far this has not been deconstructed in human society, that no, there is a kind of brain science piece there that actually goes to what, you know, different three-year-olds left on their own to pick up the fork to feed themselves, pick it up with a different hand, right? And in that sense, it's real, right, in quotation marks, in the sense of there's something there that is not just sort of socially constructed, right, in that way. To the extent, right, you are dealing with a category where you feel like, no, there's actually nothing there that's real, again, in quotation marks, other than the social construction, well then, yeah, you're probably gonna end up in this model. Right? None of the sources that we saw around left-handedness assume that, in keeping with the way handedness has been treated, I'd say, until today, in human society. But again, we've seen some degree of exclusion around lefties, the term sinister, and viewing them as like sources of evil. There definitely has been passing and attempts to make them be that way, et cetera, et cetera. You can imagine, there's double burden stuff, right? It's like, we're not going to give you a special left-handed desk, but I'm also going to yell at you if you write with your right hand because it's sloppy, right? It's also kind of a thing. Yeah, please.
I'll come back for a moment to the Beit HaMikdash, and you raised the question about the cost.
Yeah.
Right? So what struck me is the cost to who? I mean, the assumption is the cost may be low in terms of the culture if there are lots of people wanting to be Kohanim, but for a particular Kohen, the cost may be very high.
Correct.
So the cost depends on from whose perspective you're looking at it, no?
Absolutely right. That's absolutely right. So the part of the question is good. So let's go. Let me give you an example, okay, with a possible historical background that fleshes that out, and then Roni will get to your question. Lulav and Etrog. Why do Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi and the Itur disagree? Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi says, you switch. The Itur says, nope, everyone's the same. Okay? So they give you their local arguments. They're both ways to sort of read it, right? The Itur at the end of the day is sort of let's start with Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi. Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi, at the end of the day, is very much motivated by the sugya and Shabbat, which I want to come back and talk about, that it sort of matters what for you is sort of considered to be important and significant in the way you interact with objects, right? Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi basically very much looks at it from the perspective of the person holding the lulav and etrog. Well, clearly what matters is this derech hashivut? Is this the way that you would think of doing something serious? Okay? I don't know, you can take any number of analogs. You're going to visit like a head of state and you're going to present them, you know, with some, what hand are you going to hold the thing in? Okay? And it matters, right? That actually your hand is the one that you would do that with. And he even goes back to the Sifrei Dvarim, if you saw that, and says, right, ukshaitam uchtavtam. So which hand would you write with? That's the hand you should tie with. And that goes by you. Okay? So the Itur, why? Why is the Itur? Well, the Itur actually says something weird. He says, Mishum Chashivuta, you should all do it the same way. Right? So that's a little bit cryptic, but pretty plausible explanation was suggested to me by one of my teachers, Rabbi Lishan Shalovitz, which is that the Chashivuta there should be understood not as an internal thing of what feels important to you, but in external optics, okay, what actually is going to be perceived as the most significant way to do the mitzvah. And why would there have been a gap between Rabbeinu Yoel and the Itur, he suggests, okay? And again, whether you think this is 100% right or not, it gives you sort of a way of imagining how you think this through. Well, in northern Germany, they got one etrog and lulav for the entire community. If you read the Tosafot and other things, they're always talking about an etrog shel shutafin, and they got to bring them up from the Mediterranean. The Itur lives in Provence. in the Mediterranean basin. They're coming in by the truckload from Corfu. There's no problem. Everyone's got it. What does that mean? Well, it actually affects the cost-benefit analysis. Because you know what it is to take lulav in Germany? After the chazan is done, there's a line. And people go up, put it down, and you go. And then the next person goes. So the cost of the lefty switching it is nothing. And the gain is immense. For the itur, what do you have? Something more like the privileged hoshanot of the North American shul-going class of today. Everyone's got their own thing. And suddenly you're going around, and one person has it backwards. Well, actually, that messes it up a little bit. Or if we want to start talking about other costs, maybe what you're then sending is a message of, oh, everyone gets to do their own thing the way it's meaningful for them. And what we were supposed to be doing was showing up and following stage directions that were scripted by someone else. I'm just a bit player. All right? I'm embellishing that, right, with all kinds of language. And again, you can take that down. But it's a great example of, you might even say, yeah, what I care about is the cost. And then you start to pay attention, well, what's the cost? Right? So for sure, in conversations around sexuality, to the extent the entire discussion is, well, I assume there's no social cost to embracing varieties of sexuality in the human population. My only problem is I have some annoying verse in Vayikra that I don't know what to do with. Okay, that's one set of cost-benefit analysis. Obviously, to the extent that you have other anxieties around, well, what kinds of arrangements or, you know, validations of this or that thing are going to have larger impacts on a broader society, you're going to come out different on that question. And that, again, is where I think it's not about what's the answer, what's the model. It's who's saying what and why, right? I don't think anyone actually gets to a model of exclusion just because they're like, well, I'm stuck, there's a verse. There's an implicit claim of this is threatening in some substantive way to the community I am trying to build, right? And additionally, I don't think you get to mirror image, and certainly not to deconstruction, unless, at least if you're honest with yourself, you have already reached some conclusion that there's almost no cost, right? That's what happens around tefillin, right? On some level, there's no cost to allowing lefties to switch hands. Someone who comes sees my daughter put on tefillin and doesn't know that she's a lefty or that that's the rule may destabilize for them. Yeah, it's not so important that it has to go on my left. So her, she put it on her right. I don't know, her father's a rabbi. It's probably fine. And then, okay, so my hand was bothering me one morning. I put it on my other arm, right? There's no cost. But ultimately, the adoption of the Rambam's approach on that as the dominant halakha was an understanding of those costs are low enough on some level, and our understanding that the mitzvah is really about dominance, and I think those sort of march together. Roni, you had your, yeah, okay. We'll take a few more here. Yeah, please.
Oh, no.
No, he's passing. He yields the floor.
So I had a question about the mirror image.
Yeah.
I understand the left becomes right and the right becomes left, sort of. But in your example about the Vayikra verse,
yeah.
If you're saying that we're going to say that that verse is really only speaking to people who are straight,
right? In that model, yeah.
In the mirror image model,
right.
Therefore, there's a limitation to not do this one thing. If it's a real mirror image, then for people who are not straight, is there also something that they're restricted from doing?
Yeah, the idea would be actually that passing would be very problematic.
Okay, I mean, that's
right?
And see if there was a...
Yeah, in other words, in the mirror image model of talking about that pasuk, right, it would be some version of people are actually expected to sort of figure out and be in tune with what their natural sexuality is or their orientation or whatever it is. And then you're supposed to actually play that out, right?
I guess is there a binary or is there a...
Great. So let's talk about the sugya and Shabbat here just for a minute, okay? And then we'll go to the next questions here. Because I think that's part of what I think is so interesting about that sugya. And part of what's interesting just in terms of the stakes is, right, writing on Shabbat is a biblical prohibition that carries the punishment of stoning. All right, so we're playing in the big leagues, okay? There's no question here. This is not some lulav and etrog marching around the shul. Great, who cares, right? Okay? So it's something very serious, right? It really matters. And on some level, this discussion goes to a place you would not have expected. Because starting with the Mishnah seems to say, pshat of the Mishnah, kotev ben bimino ben bismolo, chayav, I think almost reads like, that's almost the closest you would get to deconstruction, but it's like pre-construction. It would be like, I don't care about your handedness. What I care is, you took your hand and you put some letters down on paper. And that's what matters. I don't care about your experience of writing. Wasn't an experience of meaningful the way you would write a letter. You communicated. You left a mark. You did something. That's what's unacceptable. That's probably the pshat of the Mishnah. I don't know. It seems like that's what matters. But then the Gemara comes along, okay? And on some level, it's like the editorial voice of the Gemara filling in the gaps to make Rabbi Yirmiyah and Abaye make sense, but it doesn't matter. It's the same malach. It's the same thought process here. The Gemara comes along and repeatedly assumes, sort of interrogates that Mishnah and says, wait a minute, you can't be chayav for writing with your left hand on Shabbat. Why? Mishum de'ein derech ktiva b'chach. That's not the way people write. Now, at the first line of that, you think that that's not the way people write. But then they say, oh, after Rabbi Yirmiyah says, maybe that's talking about a lefty. They're like, wait a minute. A lefty can't be chayav for writing with their right. Kuz ein derech ktiva b'chach. And then you realize, oh, wait a minute. They're not talking about the way people write. They're talking about the way this person writes. And the way this person writes actually determines whether there has been a biblical level stoning violation or nothing. Now, okay, it's still patur v'alasur in Hilchot Shabbat. It doesn't mean it's like okay to just write with your non-dominant hand. But again, on the level of what we're sort of talking about in terms of what the Torah cares about, it's saying, yeah, then the rest is like sort of like keeping order of like we can't let people just willy-nilly do things that are generally things very close to them are high stakes forbidden. But the core claim there is actually quite a dramatic claim, which is that the derech ktiva that determines Hilchot Shabbat is kind of based on you. The other thing that's, I think, sort of even more remarkable about that is it's actually kind of fundamentally an internally policed and reported category. You can see that someone is a left-hand person. You know, if it's like your kid and they're three, you can figure it out. And yeah, I can But if you were really committed, right, to once you got out of your parents' house, whatever it was, like behaving like a right, you could probably conceal a lot of that, right? That is, say, on some level, it's saying you actually have to know who you are, what's the way you normally write, and actually this halacha around Shabbat responds to that. Now, and then thrown into that is, there's also another subset of people who are ambidextrous, who have their own kind of law of Shabbat, where writing with both hands is significant. Okay, so if, again, and this is like a big if, and how do you make the leap, and what's the way, but I'm trying to throw out models for you, right? The notion of saying, well, what does it look like if you replace, you know, ein derech ktiva b'chach to, you know, derech zugiyut b'chach, or whatever your preferred term is that doesn't sound too 20th century and can fit into a rabbinic text, but something that sort of imagines, oh, so that pasuk is forbidding something. What is it forbidding? Oh, maybe you originally thought it was forbidding like a specific anatomical act. No, that's not what it's talking about. Again, I'm just playing out what mirror image looks like, right? That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about some notion of, I mean, you can even imagine reading it into the verse. Ve'et zachar lo tishkav mishkevei isha. Right? Someone who hears a verse and says, well, the normal, right, or sort of default experience of intercourse that I would have would be with a woman. That's the person to whom it's speaking, and therefore that verse applies to them. And the mirror image would apply to someone who was wired differently, as it were. Okay? Now, you talk about then, this is where the non-binary piece is also potentially relevant, though it's going to get into the same questions of what do you think is really going on in ground conditions and brain science and all kinds of things like that. But to the extent that, great, there's ambidextrous people, and you want to apply that in a sexuality model as well. So you'd be saying, well, yeah, there are some people for whom the derech zugiut is in multiple directions, right? That is to say, that's what's describing them, the same way the ambidextrous person in Abaye has a different setup than the lefty or the righty. All right, so that helps just sort of unpack. That's where it goes. And then we can still sort of play out. You're still going to be in a lot of those same cost-benefit questions. And like, well, why apply that model? And why not this model? And why not that model? But that's what I think it looks like to the extent one was going to use the Gemara in Shabbat to play that out. It would look something like that. Yeah?
I really wanted to ask about playing out this Shulet v'Shteyada situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me that in some ways the burden is so much more consistent on this person than it is on the left-handed person who has this mirror image fixed. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Shulet v'Shteyada, at best, gets to pass all the time for a right-handed person and sometimes gets the exclusion and the double burden. And, you know, doesn't seem in any of the texts we look at to, like, be living a whole mirror image life or deconstructed life or whatever our other options might be.
Great. So, okay, good. So a couple things on this. Yeah, I think it makes sense that the ambidextrous person alone, they're not going to live in a world of deconstructedness alone while everyone else doesn't, right? That is to say, to the extent the categories, the underlying value, whatever it is, still matters, okay, then it still matters in some sort of broader social or religious consequence way. And I think that we wouldn't expect that, like, there's some sort of carve out for that. And here I would say the two Abayes are interesting, right? You sort of wonder, is Abaye ambidextrous, right? Like, in these different places, he comes up mentioning this category. So here, I don't know, and you can help me think it through. Like, I think this is right, but you can tell me if it's not, if it doesn't sound correct. In Tfilin, okay, where Abaye is dealing with two conflicting texts, okay? And just to mention that, because I said it before, that first text is so amazing, right? What's that?
Not that pen.
No, that would be bad, yes. Okay, thank you. I put it in my pocket. Here it is. Great.
With your left hand.
Great. Okay. Someone have the menachot here just so you read it to me. The iter maniach.
Iter maniach tefillin bimino shehu smolo.
Okay, just stop there. Bimino shehu smolo. Okay. I'm going to come back to your point, all right, just by way of this text. Iter maniach bimino shehu smolo. That is like, it's like a self-parody text of this topic because you cannot know what that means. I actually think the Gemara is conscious of this. You cannot know. It either means a left-handed person puts tefillin on his right hand, which is his non-dominant hand, or a left-handed person puts tefillin on his dominant hand, which is his left. But yamin and smol, one of them is playing on the axis of dominance, and one of them is playing on the axis of side. You cannot know until the next braita is brought in as a challenge, where it says smolo, shehu smolo shel kol adam, which obviously means on his side, which is everyone else's that side. It can't mean his non-dominant, which is everyone else's non-dominant, because his non-dominant is not everyone else's non-dominant. But actually, until that happens, you don't know what's going on here, okay? So that's just a sort of side point to note this. The Gemara there, I think, is actually engaging with its awareness that this term is underdetermined until you've figured out what you're talking about. Now, in response to that, yes, Abaye, once this has been clarified in opposition to the other Braita, as meaning right. And Abaye says, that text is all about the ambidextrous person. And then I have no conflict, okay? Because I have, the lefty, right, puts it on his left like everything else. And it's the opposite. It's not this
the
text.
The other side of the marker,
right, thank you. This means right, okay? But the ambidextrous person, okay, is the other breita, which is maniach bismolo. He puts it on his left. So then Abaye makes the claim, yes, the ambidextrous person is going to conform to the majority, right? At the end of the day, all right, and here we can get into what's the cost or the this or that. At the end of the day, the ambidextrous person, I think the way Abaye thinks about it is, it's kind of not really a big deal to the ambidextrous person necessarily which hand they put it on. Therefore, barring the feeling that this will be a totally bizarre experience of putting tefillin on the dominant arm, so the ambidextrous person should go with the majority. Right? So great. That's definitely a model of saying, okay, fine, there's some sort of value in general by default to being a part of that majority pattern, but also there's a whole meaningful part of the human population that's not, and it's different. The Shabbat text, I think, is a little different. I'm not sure it plays out the same way. Because the Shabbat text, I think, is naming the ambidextrous person. See, Shabbat text is tricky, right? Because it's an isur and not a mitzvah. But the question is to think about it actually as a model of a mitzvah that just happens to be a negative mitzvah. Okay? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, what about Ketuvat Sefer Torah?
That
actually strikes me as a big burden. You have an ambidextrous person, sofer, who
they'd rather switch off.
Yeah, you know, they could be doubly effective right. If you would let them write their Sefer Torah as an ambidextrous person.
Great. Well, what do you mean? They'd be doubly effective because, I mean, their hand won't be as tired. Like, they won't get tired out. Right? Okay, good. So, look, I think this is what brings you back to the question of, okay, well, what's the problem? What's at stake? Okay? Put another way. I don't think you can answer the question of why is it important for the ambidextrous person to write with their right hand without answering what would be so bad if a righty wrote with their left, right? To the extent you really don't care about the righty writing with their left at all, it's going to be very hard for you to come up with an answer to that question. To the extent you have some way of talking about why, actually, it's really important that righties don't write with their left, then I think you can imagine how there may be fallout.
But I disagree, because okay. Especially if we're talking about Sefer Torah, there's huge stakes with somebody who can't write well with a given hand trying to write a Sefer Torah with their hand. But somebody who can't, I think the bigger question is what's so bad about a left-handed person writing with their left hand?
But there's not. For that, they say it's fine for a lefty to write with their left.
Find somebody else to do it.
No, that's only the right, if a right-handed, No. Well, there's different views there. Okay. But the view that the Ramah cites at the end is, Iter, his left is like everyone else's right. He has no problem with a left-handed sofer. Okay, but he would say, look, at the end of the day, no, I don't want a single person writing with both of their hands. I don't want a sense of sort of switching back and forth. And given that the Iter doesn't really care which one they write with, I'm going to say, fine, you fall into line. Now, the second you'll say to me, no, but this Iter really cares. So then we have to deconstruct. Well, what's going on there? Why? To the extent it's, well, I'd like to be able to write twice as fast. So the answer might be, sorry. Right? That's not the value here. Okay? Or, there, I don't know. It could be you would dig deep and dig up a posek that would say, yeah, it's okay for the Iter to switch back and forth. That wouldn't shock me that there would be someone who would say that, right? Partly because I think there is an element of that going on with Abaye in the Shabbat case, which is to say, again, the Shabbat case is formulated in the negative, but I think Abaye is basically saying, well, if you're asking about writing, that's the same for this person on both hands. So here we're dealing with a negative mitzvah, so it means you'll be chayav chatat. Doesn't strike me as conceptually unimaginable that you can imagine that in the context of positive mitzvah, but it's true in most of the psakim that you see because of tefillin, because tefillin in the Gemara comes out that way, so there's a general assumption that you break that way. Okay? But here's the thing also, particularly when people talk about bisexuality and sort of just being sort of in non-easily, you know, binary categories of attraction, relationship, etc. So then maybe there's other language for that. That's not about ambidexterity, may not be even the best language for that, but ambidexterity may capture in this sugya the notion that you're actually trying to look at who a person is and figure out how the halakha applies to them. Now, what's different about this, and in a way it goes back to what you said earlier, Eliana, what is different between models 4 and 5, and this I think is actually quite significant, and I think part of where there is sort of mixed reaction with respect to this shiur and sort of thinking it through as a model. The mirror image model, and quite frankly, pretty much all of the halachic sources, I would say do two things. One, they really do take note of kind of human difference and diversity, right? Like, it matters who's a lefty in all these sources. Like, it's not ignored. It's not erased. Even exclusion is not erasure, right? It's like, no, actually, you're really a lefty, and therefore you can't serve in the Mikdash. It's like, I don't want to hear about which hand you use. Right? No, okay? The first thing they do is they really do take note of difference, okay? But the second thing they do is they then assume once we've sort of figured out that difference, again, a good deal of which may be sort of self-reported and discovered, that then people other than the person themselves have an investment and sort of a stake in what happens. When you deconstruct a category, part of what you're saying is, I want to get away from this consideration entirely, right? I want to eliminate the factor, in this case, of handedness, or it could be gender, it can be sexuality, it can be all the categories that you want to talk about here. I actually want to move beyond them in a way that essentially just allow people to, whether it's to self-present, show up, self-define, whatever it is, in a way that no one else is sort of defining for you what category you're in. Right? That is a difference, right? That's a meaningful difference between those two, and presumes that there's something that we, in the sense of which I mean some amalgam of the Torah, society, community, etc., care about something that's at stake here beyond just what the individual determines is best for their flourishing. Yeah.
So I'm not sure that's a legitimate move.
Okay, go ahead.
So I think you can say that deconstruction, that might be a legitimate move to say that deconstruction means that, but I think it's equally legitimate to say that deconstruction might mean we are getting away from that category, but we still have something to say about how it plays out, because we, you know, there's a communalness to halakha and the whole psak system, so we still need to talk about why handedness might be important to the larger society under various circumstances. And it might be that deconstruction has two categories, or it might be that there's another category, which is one of those things, right, that we just mentioned. But I'm not sure it's a legitimate.
Well, tell me if this is what you mean.
Deconstruction necessarily means that we're getting rid of the category, but then nobody has anything to say about it except for the person themselves.
No. So, okay, let me clarify what I'm saying. In part, we might still disagree, but I want to make sure you're understanding what I'm saying. When I'm talking about I'm claiming deconstruction in any given application of some halakha is a claim of, in this case, let's say we're talking about handedness. Handedness no longer matters in that area. Is it possible to come along and say, well, I think handedness doesn't matter in the context of lulav anymore, but I think it still matters in tefillin? Yeah, you could totally claim that, right? That would be an argument that it means something when Rabbah uses it in sukkah that's very different from what it means in menachot. So to the extent I came off as saying, oh, once you sort of deconstruct it means you have nothing to say about that category at all, I don't mean to say that. But I am saying that in any given area, if you move to a place where you're no longer trying to figure out how people are different from one another and therefore how the halakha responds to them, but in a sort of actually normative and limiting way, but instead you are saying, we're actually not concerned about sorting people in that way at all anymore, then I think, at least with respect to that area, you're saying, we're not telling people what to do in that area.
So we're just, in other words, you're saying, we're going to say that we are now lifting lulavs with our teeth.
No, so you could say handedness doesn't matter, but hands matter.
Okay.
That's fine.
You can dig it with any hand at all times.
Yeah.
And we don't really even discuss hands.
Yeah, who cares?
Okay.
Right, you could, in other words, you could emerge from a picture of, you could come out of Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi's culture in Germany, and this may be part of what the Itur or others are even afraid of, being like, I don't know, it seems like it's not that big a deal. I see people taking lulav in the other hand. Okay, they say they're a lefty, but does that really matter? It seems like people do it, you know, different ways, and maybe actually it doesn't matter anymore. Right.
So the lulav might matter, but the hand
is. That's right. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't mean you have nothing to say about lulav.
We still have all kinds of other rules about the lulav.
Correct.
But whatever
hand. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't mean, for instance, just because you move away from any assumption that a person has a sexual orientation or that that sorts people in some way, doesn't mean you don't have anything to say about sex. But it does mean, I think, if you move to that, you're in a different place in terms, you're no longer looking like what these sources look on left-handed and right-handed. That's where they assume, well, that's like something real and meaningful and with some stakes for large parts of the population. It's not one size fits all, but the fact that it's not one size fits all doesn't mean there aren't sizes, right? Some version of that. Yeah.
It just seems to me that like he's motivated or encouraged to apply some of these models more often than others, especially for taking them from this context and applying them to other things, especially things that have greater impacts on our lives. I'm just curious if you think that there's like a hierarchy to them or like a science for how we should apply them, because there seems to be just some that feel easier, and just like how we make like informed choices about applying these models.
Yeah. It's a great question. I'm not sure, and on some level, I resist there being like an answer. I'll give you, I guess, two comments. I mean, one of the things when I was sort of like pulling together this material and thinking about the application in this case, and in some level, this led to my like arranging it in this way. But, you know, there is something actually very striking of, you could write kind of the history of same-sex relationships in America as like going down this list, okay? Particularly in religious communities. That is to say, get out. You're a complete threat to like any sexual ethic I'm trying to have. Okay, fine, tolerate it, but just fall into line. Yes, I recognize you, but we can't actually make any kind of accommodation. Oh, great, yes, you're different from everyone else, but you know, there's still sort of different rules. And then maybe we've been not thinking about this category right at all. And I actually think on some level it's like, this is, right, various parts of the Jewish community are playing in this zone now in various ways and trying to figure out where they are, how they talk about it, what they turn, you know, blind eye to, whether it's reality on the ground or the Torah, and are like, how do we fix? So there's something that I think there is sometimes with something that the underlying consensus that had been in place before in society crumbles. There's a little bit of like a vector that sometimes passes here. But the bigger picture, I would say, part of what I take from some of the variety of what we've seen is, I think what the Mikorot encourage us to do is to actually not dismiss any of these, really, but to think about, like, what's at stake. Like, if anything, part of what I'm actually calling for, and again, it really doesn't actually push for any specific position on whatever your issue is can you sort of intelligently articulate, like, Well, yeah, because I think we can't do this now effectively. I think if you think long and hard about this, you will find that you have every single one of these categories for something in your opinion of how you organize communal life, right? You know, passing all the time. You're like, I don't judge what you do on Shabbat, okay? But in this synagogue, we don't use cell phones. I'm telling you, you have to not use it. I understand. That's it. You have to do that here, right? That's a form of passing, right? And people who bristle at feeling like they're sort of hypocritically pretending to not be who they are don't like that a lot of times. And for other people, it's like, yeah, but I'm trying to create something here, and your difference from the mean is shattering it, right? And of course, we do exclusion all the time with behaviors that we basically think are destructive and can't be rehabilitated, right? I mean, there are people who are sex offenders against children and all kinds of other things where it's like a huge swath of the country, they just can't even live, right? Yeah, most of us probably feel fine about that, okay? Maybe we're a little conflicted sometimes. So that's actually what I'm really pushing is I'm both advocating for sort of maybe this is a useful model for thinking about how you could read a verse in the Torah and feel like, yeah, that's my verse. And here's how it applies or doesn't apply in my world. That's one thing I'm suggesting. But I'm also sort of throwing out, what does it look like to really confront the ways we manage uniformity and diversity? I would say a healthy approach to communal policy and to halakha you would have things in each category, but you would know why, and you'd be transparent about it. That's, I'd say, what I would advocate for. A couple of, folks who haven't had a chance yet.
So I'm thinking on the mirror image as described by Ramban, vis-a-vis the one by Yoel Levy, because Ramban says, Minal Shavu Smolo, and Yoel Levy says, Minal Shavu Smol Kol Ha'adam. And I think there's a big difference there, because as a lefty, I would feel offended if you call my left hand my right hand. So I think the mirror image has two levels that are very, very different, because it's not only about how we apply the rule, it's also about how we talk.
It's what's the language. That's great. Yeah. That's great. Right. A mirror image can be formulated as like, great. I mean, it's sort of like who's standing on what side of the mirror, right?
It's
great.
Christmas, the Jewish hat. Is Hanukkah the Jewish Christmas?
Great.
Or no.
Great.
It's to me what Christmas is to you.
Great. And so wait, and just sort of spell it out for me. Give me the language, not in the technical of Yamin and Smol. Give me a couple sentences or a couple examples of what does the mirror image model look like that's not implicitly sort of like, well, this is the normal and this is the abnormal exception mirror.
For example, I think I could say that my gay friend loves his partner as much as I love my wife. And it's very different to say that his partner is his wife.
Great. Yeah.
So picking up on what was just said, how do we deal with the whole issues of, we have a whole ethical norm for on sexual behavior within marriage. We have a whole category of lo tina. How do we deal with that? And how does that apply in same-sex relationships? And do we not, as a Jewish community, have a right to have a judgment about people who violate heterosexual couples who violate their vows? Does that apply in same-sex couples the same way?
And great. Great. So on some level, what's that?
And then we're going to throw the polyamory wrench.
Great. So with 2 minutes left, let me say the following. Let's see what I can get to here. In a way, if you're in a mirror image world, the answer to your question should be very easy, right? Which is to say, and I would say advocates for having not a, kiddushin parallel, but kiddushin, right, for same-sex relationships are sort of all about, on some level, saying, well, if I really want a mirror image model, I want to build that up in a robust way with all the heaviness and consequence and not just sanctity, right? But what comes with sanctity traditionally in Jewish heterosexual marriage. And I want to build that up in that way. And in a way, that's very easy. Here's the challenge, and I actually think this is the challenge around the discussions of sexuality now writ large, and polyamory is the best example of it. There is a simultaneous deconstruction and throwing off of all kinds of other things at the same time that we are also noticing diversity and difference. And that begins to create a tremendous amount of confusion, because some people will hear your statement and say, yes, that's exactly what I want. More people subject to lo tinaf. And other people will say some version of, I've been trying to get away from lo tinaf for a long time. Not because I'm pro-adultery, but because all I can hear with lo tinaf is that the man can't be guilty of it when he cheats on his wife. Okay? Now, that too, that's a different kind of mirror image that we haven't been talking about, which is a mirror image of egalitarianism, where you could say, well, no, right? We don't have death penalties that we apply today for reasons we are definitely mostly glad about. But on a theoretical question, I think it actually is a deep question, right? Do I think on some level that I should be liable for the death penalty by stoning if I cheat on my wife? Right? Like, what's the answer to that, right? A real sort of, again, this is not mirror image around sexuality or handedness, just about egalitarianism, would say, well, yeah, I actually want to build that up, right, as equal in some way. I want to see that to have been a sort of incomplete equation from an earlier point in time, but I don't want to move in the other direction of neither partner is capable of committing adultery. But that's not how everyone feels, right? Overall, I would say that is my inclination. If you're asking me personally, my inclination is I would say to you, I'm overall on the side of, I think the fundamental concept of marriage as it was laid out in Jewish sources, that its main problem is its imbalanced equality, but not its severity. But not everyone feels that way, right? I would say I'm far from clearly in the majority on that one, all right? But that's a real choice. Until you answer that, I don't think you can have an answer to your question, which is corollary. Polyamory, obviously, now is sort of playing out the question of, well, yeah, do we think the whole notion of being in a monogamous relationship is itself repressive of the individual, right? So I would say to you, again, from my perspective, I would say absolutely not. I don't think there's any stable or real legitimate place in a grounded halachic conversation for that. But that's not where, you know, where a lot of the larger questioning in society necessarily is or is moving. And this is part of the thing that I think is difficult and complex. And I actually think at times there's something actually tragic about it in a way, is that just as, right, you know, it's like this has been a sort of complaint and tragic element of the advance of feminism in Western society in general, right? It's like, just as women get into a profession, oh, so then the wages fall, or it becomes less prestigious, or why is it so important, you know, to have the title rabbi? Right? Why does that really matter? It mattered for a long time, apparently, but now, right? And there are a lot of dynamics like that that happen, where as soon as you start opening up some of the questions actually about recognizing difference, part of my nervousness about jumping to the deconstruction is that I actually think before we have fully accounted for real difference, we rush to undo the category. It doesn't mean categories don't need to be undone. And going back to your comment earlier, it's never a blanket thing of getting rid of something entirely. But I think part of what we see from the richness of the sources we saw is there's a lot to say, actually, about noticing difference along the way. I'm going to respect people's time, Dan, but I'm happy to sit around and talk. I'll say, again, I offered this to you as something that maybe is useful. on the front of the nimshal, as it were, of applying to sexuality. But even if you think it's totally unhelpful for that, I think it's actually a remarkable example of just seeing models at play for grappling with uniformity and diversity. And again, I give you as your homework, find the places where you believe in each of these five categories. And maybe we'll schmooze about it over breakfast and lunch. Shkach.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.